Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, here with your engineer, Cynthia McClure. Thank you for joining us. As usual, I'm happy and eager to bring you the stories we have gathered to share with you today. Selenia Binyaz, survivor of Auschwitz and the last living person who was on the so-called Schindler's List, will be telling a little of her story and informing us about a very unusual and special concert that her grandson will perform tonight in Des Moines. Cal Halliburton brings an interview with presidential candidate John Delaney, another installment in his series Candidates with Cal. Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty Hansen will stop by for her monthly update from the Ames City Council, and KHOI reporter Pat Schlaubaum will be offering information about an unstoppable uprising that is silently and invisibly happening right now in our community. I'm referring to TreeSap, and that's about as close as I'm going to get to an April Fool's joke today. It is April 1st. Do you know what is happening to trees in spring? Stick with us to find out. As always, to get us started, here is the unstoppable Mr. Dennis Hart.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be back here on this Monday. Healthcare made big news around Iowa late last week with word that more than 400,000 poor or disabled Iowans are about to lose their health insurer. United Healthcare, which manages healthcare for more than two-thirds of those state residents who are on Medicaid, is leaving the market. That departure, which will come in the next few months, will take place because contract negotiations collapsed. United Healthcare is the second Medicaid management company to bail out of Iowa since the state's decision to privatize its Medicaid system back in 2016. Governor Kim Reynolds' office said United Healthcare members could continue seeing their healthcare providers as usual for the time being. Politics also made big news around Iowa and the nation last week. Here in the state, both Republican U.S. Senators, Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, called on U.S. Attorney General William Barr to release the full details of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Barr's summary report indicated there was no evidence that President Trump or any members of his campaign conspired with Russia's effort to sway the 2016 election. Both Senators Grassley and Ernst called for more than just the summary. Grassley said Barr should release the full report to, in the senator's words, finally put an end to the speculation and innuendo that has loomed over this administration since its earliest days. Senator Ernst said, in her words, taxpayers have paid millions for this investigation. It's only right that they see its findings. Attorney General Barr said he would be releasing the report soon. Meanwhile, Democratic Party presidential hopefuls continued making their way to Iowa last week. Among them, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. In Perry, in Dallas County, Warren said the United States has a chance to change the course of the country by, in her words, attacking corruption, changing economic rules, and protecting democracy. She said the things she's asking for are hard, but again, in her words, we can't quit now. We have a chance to dream big and fight hard and win this thing in 2020. Minnesota Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Amy Klobuchar also trekked to Iowa last week. She said one of her goals is to connect every American household to the Internet by 2022, which she called one way to bridge the rural-urban divide. Then both Warren and Klobuchar joined former U.S. Housing Secretary Julian Castro and former Maryland Congressman John Delaney, who are also running for the Democratic presidential nomination, at the Heartland Forum in Storm Lake this past weekend. They all criticized the role of giant agribusiness for advancing climate change, killing small towns, and closing small and medium-sized farms. Each pledged to reinforce or redesign America's antitrust laws that would prevent large corporate mergers. Castro also showed up at the Farm Grounds Coffee House in Nevada. There, he told the crowd that if he were elected president, he would spend every day, in his words, working so that you and your family can have good health care, that your kids and grandkids could get a good education, and that you can get a job opportunity no matter your background. He said he's running for president to bring new leadership and new vision to the nation. Also last week, the state Senate in Iowa approved a measure to define an unborn person in Iowa law as part of a measure increasing penalties for ending a woman's pregnancy without her consent, such as by killing or injuring the woman in a car crash or while committing a felony. The bill now moves on to the Iowa House, where its future is unclear. The Iowa House was also busy approving a proposed constitutional amendment that would restore voting rights for felons who have completed their sentences. The measure moves on to the state Senate, where it needs to advance through the committee process before the end of this week in order to meet a legislative deadline. Meanwhile, a new law in Iowa will require public universities and community colleges to respect free speech on campus. Governor Kim Reynolds signed the law last week. It requires institutions of higher education to adopt policies respecting free speech on campus. Conservative students and groups nationwide have claimed that their free speech rights have been restricted on liberal campuses. Also last week, 15 suspected gang members were charged in connection with a sweep through Des Moines, a series of arrests that police officials said would have a lasting effect on public safety in Iowa. Authorities said the charges served as a warning to violent gang members and drug dealers in the state. In addition to the charges, more than a dozen guns were seized, along with 2 pounds of powdered cocaine, more than 2 pounds of marijuana, drug paraphernalia, and $24,000 in cash. There was much more last week, including word that the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa had appealed a ruling that could limit the public's access to information about officer-involved shootings and other investigations. The group appealed a February ruling by the Iowa Public Information Board, a ruling that gave its blessing to police agencies that withhold videos, 911 calls, and other records from the public. There was also word that roads in western Iowa may take a couple of months, if not longer, to be rebuilt following weeks of flooding. Sections of Interstates 29 and 680, along with Highway 34 and State Highway 2, suffered some of the worst damage. Also last week, a report that the nation's two biggest beer producers, who were in a public relations battle over corn syrup, stepped up their drinking water donation efforts in those parts of the Midwest affected by the recent devastating flooding. Anheuser-Busch announced the donations of about 250,000 cans of water to flooded communities in Iowa and Nebraska. MillerCoors announced its own donation of 100,000 cans of drinking water to Sioux City and to Omaha. Both companies have ramped up their ongoing marketing feud in recent weeks, a feud sparked by Anheuser-Busch's beer commercials accusing MillerCoors of using corn syrup in its products. On the court beat, trial for the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts has been moved to a different county than where the crime allegedly took place. After defendant Christian Bahena Rivera's lawyer requested a new location for the trial, the Poweshiek County Attorney and the Iowa Attorney General's offices responded in a motion by saying that a fair and impartial jury could not reasonably be selected in Poweshiek County. Instead, the trial will be held in Sioux City in Woodbury County. If he's convicted, Bahena Rivera will be sentenced to life in prison without parole. Meanwhile, an Indiana man accused of killing a Fort Dodge woman whose body was found burned in a field pleaded guilty to attempted murder last week. 26-year-old Philip Williams of Lafayette, Indiana, had been set to go on trial for first-degree murder in the killing of Jessica Gomez in 2017. Instead, Williams avoided trial by pleading guilty to attempted murder. He faces up to 32 years in prison. If he had gone to trial and been convicted of first-degree murder, he would have been sentenced to life in prison. Also last week, a Des Moines public school employee faced several felony charges after child pornography was found on his home computer. 50-year-old Thatcher Lane Williams was charged with 5 counts of sexual exploitation of children. Williams was the office manager at Monroe Elementary School, but he resigned last week when he learned charges would be filed. There was a grim discovery in northwest Iowa last week. A man's body was found on a shore of the Floyd River near Northwest Iowa Community College in Sheldon. It appeared the body had been underwater before it was discovered. In West Des Moines, a speeding food truck may be the reason a large vehicle barreled into a home last Wednesday, trapping 2 people inside the truck's cab. A passenger inside the truck was taken to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The only person inside the house was not injured. On the animal beat, the Animal Rescue League of Iowa announced a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction in the deaths of 2 dogs found in the Raccoon River. Deputies found the dogs north of Dawson in northwest Dallas County. That reward announcement came one day after the Iowa House of Representatives passed a bill that increases penalties for those convicted of animal cruelty or mistreatment. In another case, the owner of a northern Iowa dog breeding operation was charged with animal neglect. 66-year-old Barbara Cavers of Manly is charged with 17 counts. Authorities said Cavers was holding dogs in inhumane conditions when her operation was raided last November. 17 dogs allegedly had skin conditions leading to fur loss, painful wounds, intestinal parasites, and other maladies. In sports last week, Iowa State University's women's basketball team lost its NCAA tournament game against Missouri State on Monday night in Ames. The final score was 69-60. The University of Iowa women's team fared much better, defeating North Carolina State 79-61 this past Saturday and clinching the Hawkeyes' first Elite Eight appearance in the tournament since 1993. Also last week, Iowa State University's men's basketball coach Steve Prohm signed a 3-year contract extension. He is now under contract through the year 2025. And a former Iowa State men's basketball coach also made big news last week with word that Fred Hoiberg is returning to the college ranks. He signed a 7-year, $25 million contract to become coach at the University of Nebraska. And there you have it on this Monday, your summary of the week's news from around Iowa. In fact, all the news fit to broadcast. I'm Dennis Hart, taking the next few days off to recuperate, but promising to find more news, this time from Ames, on Friday, when I will return to this very seat. In the meantime, have a great week.
This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. And that, of course, was Rain by the Beatles in honor of this first day of April, the month of transition weather. It shouldn't rain today, though, and tomorrow is expected to be partly sunny with temps in the high 50s both days, which is awesome. Wednesday and Thursday should see a 10-degree or more drop in temperature and April showers. After that, temperatures should start climbing again. By the weekend, we should be in the 60s, closing in on 70 degrees. Friday and Saturday should be partly sunny. Last night, an audience of several hundred people at the student union at Iowa State listened to a presentation by Ms. Selenia Binez. Ms. Binez is the last living member of what has been called Schindler's List. Schindler was a Nazi industrialist who came to terms with the meaning of what being a Nazi was and what they were doing during the Third Reich, and ended up using his factory and his resources to create a safe haven to preserve the lives of the 1,100 Jewish slaves working in his factory. Steven Spielberg made this story famous with his movie Schindler's List. Binez was the youngest person on the list and the youngest worker in the factory. And according to her, Spielberg's movie, which is based on the testimonies of his workers who survived, the movie documents very accurately exactly what happened. Ms. Binez recorded an hour-long interview at KHOI last week, and we will play that in May at Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance for the Holocaust. Here, though, is a brief excerpt from her interview, where she talks about her 7-week experience of being in the concentration camp and death camp Auschwitz, and how this relates to the very unusual concert that will occur in Des Moines tonight, brought to her by her grandson and the Iowa Jewish Historical Society, and this concert is open to the public. A word of warning, she does give a description of experiences of meeting Dr. Mengele, who was the person who decided, who lived and died at Auschwitz, and it's an upsetting account. And also, she talks about the Shoah Foundation, which is free information. If you don't know it, it's a foundation that has dedicated itself to gathering testimonies of survivors of first the Holocaust and now other genocides that are occurring around the world. So let's listen to Ms. Benyes for a few minutes.
The concert involves my grandson, Alex Benyes Harris, and his piano partner, Ambrose Zone. The two of them met each other at USC, majors in music, and they worked for the Shoah Foundation as interns. And at one point, they got together and composed a piano piece for four hands that is called Melodies from Auschwitz. They listened to people's testimonies and wove the themes and music ideas that some of the people in concentration camps mentioned, and then wrote this three-part music. I don't know what to call it. It's a piece in three movements. They're both coming. My grandson is flying in with me, and Ambrose is flying in, and they're going to play that. And I will add to that with Memories from Auschwitz, which is some interesting poetry. At least I think it's interesting.
You were living in Poland, is that correct?
As a child, I was.
And where in Poland were you living as a child?
In Krakow. And then I went through the Krakow ghetto and the concentration camp, and we were on Schindler's List, and the women somehow were sidetracked instead of going to Schindler's factory in Czechoslovakia. We ended up in Auschwitz for about 5.5 weeks. So I am an Auschwitz person, you know, and that's why I was sent by the Shoah Foundation Memorial, 70 years anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz. So I had a very interesting experience there because I was 83 years old at the time, and I had almost like an out-of-body experience. It wasn't me looking at Auschwitz, but it was the 13-year-old girl who was there. And so afterwards, when I came back, I took a course in poetry writing, and the teacher was really great, and she was able to draw out of me the feelings of a 13-year-old girl being in Auschwitz and that whole period of time then. So I'm planning to read the poetry from the point of view of a 13-year-old after they play their music.
And is this open for the public?
Yes, it is absolutely open to the public.
And will there be a reception afterwards?
You know, I don't know, but I would assume. You don't go to a Jewish thing and not have
without food, right? What kind of a person would you say you have become, having experienced such an epic life, really?
An experience that I had in Auschwitz gave me an idea or a feeling that you can never judge people, how they behave, or the reason for what their actions are. You have to become less judgmental. And that's what I've become, much less judgmental. I was always with my mother, okay, except for one day when she volunteered to go to the kitchen to peel potatoes so she could get a few of the peels to bring back with her. Because we were hungry. I mean, there was no question about that. And it was on that day that our barrack was taken for selection by Dr., you know, the butcher of Auschwitz.
Mengele.
Yeah. So I was alone, and I had to save myself.
What did you do to save yourself?
You know, he stood there with his pencil. We were all naked in front of him, you know. And at one point, he pushed me into the area that said, no good.
No good in this case means possible death.
Oh, yes. Of course. Oh, yeah. Oh. And then he had a change of heart. I don't know why. And he beckoned that group to go through again. And I don't know what happened, but somehow I said to him, Lassen Sie mich, which means let me go. And he did. So I ran out of there naked, holding my clothes, and started dressing myself in the snow outside. And my mother at that point was coming back from the kitchen. You know, she was hysterical and I was hysterical. So that sort of left me with feelings of that you can never tell how one would act in any given situation. If my mother had been there.
When you confronted Mengele.
That's right.
When you could have been killed.
Right, at the selection. And if my mother had been there, would have been dependent upon her to save me. You cannot predict how you would act given a certain situation.
A situation of extreme danger.
That's right. Absolutely. And so you can't judge people for certain actions till you know more about it. You cannot walk in another person's shoes. You cannot predict how somebody would react in a different situation. I've become less judgmental in that sense. I've had a lot of opportunities, mm-hmm. and I'm grateful for that.
You've been doing lectures to help counteract the Holocaust denying movements in the world, but have you been able to help people feel the power of second chances in life?
I think so, because I have kids come up to me, you know, like in high school, middle school. They have problems, and some of them listen to my experiences and walk away with the idea that if I could make a meaningful life, maybe they can too.
And that was Ms. Selenia Vinyes, a last surviving member of the so-called Schindler's List. And the concert that is going to occur tonight is about music that remembers the concentration and death camp Auschwitz, performed by her grandson and another musician. They're both from Los Angeles. It'll occur tonight at 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tiferet Israel Synagogue at 924 Polk Boulevard. And it's being sponsored by the Iowa Jewish Historical Society, and it's open to everyone. It's open to the public. It's the first time they'll be performing this piece in public. And what I was told by the Iowa Jewish Historical Society was that you're welcome to come, but you need to call and reserve a seat because they're expecting a full house. And if you're interested in that, the number is 515-987-0899, extension 213. Again, that's 515-987-0899, extension 213, or look up the Tifereth Israel Synagogue in Des Moines. Presidential candidate John Delaney was in Iowa recently and stopped by KHOI. Here's Cal Halliburton with Candidates with Cal.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Congressman John Delaney. Congressman Delaney is seeking the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for President of the United States. Congressman Delaney grew up in Wood Ridge, New Jersey, the son of Elaine and Jack Delaney, an electrician. He spent part of his youth working at his father's construction site. Thanks to scholarships from his father's IBEW labor union, the American Legion, VFW, and the Lions Club, he earned a bachelor's degree from Columbia in 1985 and a law degree from Georgetown in 1988. Delaney and his wife April met at Georgetown and now have four daughters. From 1993 through 2011, Delaney co-founded and directed two successful businesses, a healthcare finance company and a commercial lender. Both traded on the New York Stock Exchange. He decided to run for Congress to represent the 6th Congressional District of Maryland and won election in 2012. While in Congress, he sponsored or co-sponsored several successful pieces of legislation. Congressman Delaney, tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine.
Well, I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan, although that's probably not hard to find because I've mentioned it before. I've seen him 30 times in concert. So being in a studio here makes me think of that. So that's something that people may not know about me. You know, and maybe it's because I'm from New Jersey, but in truth, his music really speaks to me, and I think it speaks to a lot of the struggles and promise of our country. So that's one little detail, but otherwise that was a really nice, concise bio of me. I think that was the best I've ever heard.
As you talk with people around the country, what are their most frequent concerns?
The issue that comes up the most is healthcare. you know, healthcare is so important to everyone, obviously. It's the biggest part of our economy, and we've got a really broken healthcare system. And that's probably the issue that comes up consistently around this country, no matter where I am. I'll tell you the issue that comes up a lot in Iowa, though, in addition to healthcare, is a lot of anxiety around whether people's kids will be able to find jobs in their community. And I think it's a real concern, and they're right to be concerned about it, because there's a tremendous amount of what I call economic opportunity concentration in this country. And what I mean by that is a relatively small number of places are really getting all the jobs, and they're getting all the new investment, and they're getting all the opportunities. And unless you're born in one of those places, it's just a lot harder. And that issue, because, you know, your state is full of all these wonderful small towns, and you go to a lot of these small towns, as you know, and you can see etched on the buildings in the town square the businesses that used to be there, and they're not there anymore. Businesses that have replaced them are fundamentally different in many ways. And there's just a lot of anxiety about that. And I think it's really one of the central issues we face in this country, this tremendous concentration of economic opportunity. We talk about wealth inequality and income inequality, which is huge, getting worse. But there's really also this opportunity inequality. And folks in Iowa bring that up a lot.
Well, that's good to hear that they're bringing it up. It seems as though those opportunities are just focused on a few very large communities, mostly on the East and West Coasts.
It's true. I mean, I like to tell people that last year, 80% of the venture capital in this country, you know, which is considered the smart money, it went to 50 counties out of almost 3,100. So you got 80% of the money going to 50 places. Yet you got about 70-80% of our kids live in a county where the jobs that are getting created are worse than the jobs that used to exist. That's a real problem.
Yeah. And they don't begin to pay as much. They don't supply health care.
Nope.
They don't supply any other opportunities other than a low wage.
And it makes it really tough for people. And it's a corrosive effect. Because people have to work two or three jobs. They don't have time for their family. They don't have time for relationships. They don't have time for their community. And it's really putting a tremendous amount of stress on a lot of communities in this country.
What kind of specific recommendations do you have to deal with this, what a lot of people label as rural development?
You know, I've got some very specific ideas, and I kind of break it down into these four pieces to it that I think would make a real difference. The first actually has become law, and I was one of the authors of it in the Congress. And it was a bill called the Opportunity Zone legislation. And what it does is it gives every governor the ability to draw opportunities in their state, and every governor has already done it. And if people invest in those places, then they get a federal tax incentive to do it. So that, I think, is really smart because it breaks down this. You know how these states and these communities like compete against each other to get businesses, which I think is a bit of a race to the bottom? What this does is create an incentive for investors to invest in communities across the country on the same terms. So I think that's good. The second thing I would do is I would create a incentive for government contractors to locate in these communities. And the way I do that is I would create a preference. So I'd say in my administration, 25% of the government contracts going forward are going to go to companies that have half of their employees in these same opportunity zones. So that creates a real incentive for people to locate shop in these places. Third thing I would do is build infrastructure to connect these communities more to the modern economy. I mean, some communities don't have, you know, high-speed internet access, and you got people and the kids go home and try to do their homework with dial-up service. And then the fourth thing I would do is there's something that I'm a big fan of, and it's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And it's a tax credit that actually puts cash in the pockets of hardworking Americans. I'd like to double it across this whole country, but at a minimum, I'd like to double it for people in these opportunity zones. If you did those four things, creating incentives for private capital, public capital, jobs, and make it easier for workers, I think you'd start seeing some real economic growth in a lot of places. So that'd be my plan.
Connected with that, you mentioned jobs for trying to keep the kids at home.
Yep.
There's another problem that I think local people are finding here in Iowa and other rural communities, and that is they don't have enough people.
Yeah.
They don't have enough folks of employment age to put in the jobs when they bring them.
Yeah, and those problems are obviously related, right, because there's a real drain going on in these communities because people can't get jobs and they move away. Many times they don't want to, right? They'd like to stay, which is one of the reasons why immigration is so important. I mean, you go to a lot of communities, a lot of rural communities, and you realize many of them have very vibrant immigrant communities who are rejuvenating communities and bringing a lot of the young people into the schools and stuff like that. So you have to fix the economic problem, but you also have to be smart about immigration. What a lot of people don't realize about the immigration debate is there's nothing worse for a country, nothing worse than to have a shrinking population. I mean, if you look at like Russia and some of the things that we're seeing in Japan, the consequences of a shrinking population are just devastating because you basically don't have a workforce and you have no way of paying for the promises you've made. And so, you know, I always tell people who are somewhat nationalist in their orientation and they don't want immigrants, I'm like, you know, you really got to think about what you're really, what your policy really, where it'll take us. Because, you know, birth rates are down in the United States of America the last couple of years. We still have a self-sustaining population, but a lot of countries don't. But what's caused us to grow and have such economic growth is immigration. So that's a part of it.
What do you plan to do to kind of change that disposition we have toward banning immigration?
Well, it, you know, it takes leadership, right? It takes leaders who remind the American people that we are a nation of immigrants. Immigrants provide this amazing kind of renewal to this country. You know, immigrants create jobs. They're much more likely to start a business than Americans who are not immigrants. So from an economic perspective, it's clearly very positive. And I think what we have to do, there's been this big fissure in this country over immigration. And the way to bring the country together on this issue is to actually do something. And what I think we need to do is to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And we were very close to doing that in 2013. There was a bipartisan bill that passed the U.S. Senate with significant bipartisan support. It would have passed the House of Representatives where I served, but it never got a vote. And President Obama would have signed it into law. It was a huge missed opportunity.
What would you do with that now?
I'd put it right back on the agenda. It'd be in my first 100-day agenda. We have to pass comprehensive immigration reform in this country. We have to deal with the 11 million undocumented residents of our country, create a pathway to citizenship for them. You know, it should be like what that bill had, which is it was 13 years, you couldn't commit a crime, you had to learn English, all that stuff. We need to make reforms to our visa programs, and then we need to have a much smarter conversation about border security than we've been having.
There are a whole plethora of other issues that we can cover.
Absolutely.
But, you know, let me just pick at a couple of things. We've had a particular problem with both legal and illegal drugs.
Yes.
What specifically can be done to restrict the illegal drugs and the overprescription of legal drugs?
Well, there are two different issues, but they become related, as you know, because oftentimes people get hooked on, quote, legal drugs, and then the next thing you know, they're using illegal drugs. So clearly what's happened with opioids in this country is shameful. And there was clearly very significant overprescription of these things. There were very aggressive marketing practice. There wasn't proper training. I mean, I remember getting opioids for like dental work I had done. And I remember saying, what are they giving this to me for? Clearly had issues there and we have to address it. And then we got to address the public health crisis and really the mental health crisis that's at the root cause of it. So that's what we have to do to address. And we're starting to do that. There's more that needs to be done. But as it relates to illegal, I mean, listen, a lot of drugs come in through ports of entry. We need much better security in these places, right? That's really the border crisis in many ways, is there isn't sufficient resources and technology at ports of entry to track this stuff. I mean, we have an addiction crisis in this country. I think 200 people die a day through overdoses, over 100 of them because of opioids. So we have to crack down on the people who are importing this stuff illegally by building up more robust security, mostly at ports of entry where 90% of this stuff comes in. And then we got to deal with the pharmaceutical companies who did this terrible thing on opioids to us.
How do we shift the notion that I only find good feelings when I get high from the drug or from the alcohol? Is there anything that a president can do?
Yes, there is. A lot of the conditions that create the despair that exist in our country and the depression that exists in our country are really created by a combination of economic anxiety, the erosion of the traditional institutions in our society, and the fact that in many ways things like even social media and social media addiction, particularly with kids. So I think there are things a president can do. One, a president should have economic policies that ensure economic growth in as many communities as possible. Because the root cause of a lot of this despair is economic despair and economic dislocation, where people feel like they don't have any real purpose in their life. And their life is just such an enormous struggle that this is their only really relief. So a president can have good economic policies that create those conditions. You know, we also have to have a better mental health system in this country. And there are 40 million people who are suffering from mental health in this country. And we still haven't treated mental health on parity with physical health. And so you need a robust mental health system. We need a situation where there's no bias or stigma against saying, yes, I'm suffering from a mental health issue. Because people need the treatment, you know, when they're suffering. And we don't have a real functioning mental health system nearly in the way we need it. So that's something we can do. I think we have an issue with kids and technology addiction. You know, I think they did a study in the United Kingdom last year, and it said that 50% of the teenagers wake up once a night to check their social media. But that's not the worst part. Of the 50% that wake up once a night, half of them wake up 10 times a night. So what that means is 1 in 4 of the teenagers in the United Kingdom are waking up 10 times a night to check their social media. I'm sure that's happening here, too. And that creates tremendous anxiety, you know, and we've allowed these technology companies to make these devices addictive. And it's got to stop. And there's laws that can be passed to do it.
So you're suggesting that we might restrict availability to media?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But, I mean, just like cigarette companies specifically made them addictive, so too are technology companies making these devices addictive. And the best example of this that I can give you is there was a story, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal about 6 months ago. And it said none of the executives of any of these technology companies let their kids use the devices. That's all you need to know. And so I sponsored legislation, bipartisan legislation, to have the National Institute of Health do a study of tech addiction. So it's that kind of stuff we need to do. Hmm. You know, we just address these things. Technology is extraordinarily positive. Extraordinarily positive. It's opened up society. It's created all kinds of amazing innovations. But that doesn't mean there's not a role for us as citizens to have some say in how this stuff plays out. I'm a big believer in innovation. I'm actually a big believer in capitalism, right? It's incredibly creative, but it's also disruptive. And part of the role of government is to moderate this innovation, moderate capitalism, so that it serves the common good. And every once in a while, that means stepping forward with regulations, right, to protect our citizens. That doesn't mean you're anti-innovation. It doesn't mean you're anti-capitalist. And that's what I think has just been missing in our country for so long. I think the genius of America is that we allowed capitalism to do its magic. And the magic of capitalism is it's the greatest job creation and innovation machine ever created. But we moderated it with regulation, tax policy, workers' rights, and societal infrastructure so that we effectively had a social compact. Right, so capitalism didn't completely run roughshod, but we didn't become socialist either. And that this country largely got that right better than anyone else. But about 20 years ago, we stopped doing it.
So for a while, at least, we were social capitalists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think of it as we're a capitalist country with really strong social programs. And what's happened is we've stopped updating the social programs.
Almost everything's going to be connected to money. How much money we can spend on them makes a big difference. Do you have a position on reasonable tax rates, corporate tax rates, and reasonable marginal tax rates to help fund many
It's
programs?
Money and it's also how you spend it, right? Because Democrats ought to be the party to make sure that things are funded appropriately, but that they're also managed appropriately. Corporate tax rate, it used to be 35%. That was actually too high. We were the highest in the world, and it was making us uncompetitive. What President Obama wanted to do is kind of what I wanted to do, which is to lower it to about 27%. The business community asked for 25%. Trump and the Republicans cut it to 21%. No one even asked for that. Like literally, the business community lobbied for 25. I thought it should be 27, 28. President Obama pushed for 27, 28. 35 was too high. They cut it to 21. So I think it should be kind of 27, right? I wouldn't put it back to 35 because it was too high. We weren't losing our competitive position. I think the biggest leakage with high earners is actually not the marginal rate. The biggest issue is people who invest money for a living pay a capital gains rate that's about half the tax rate that people who work for a living pay. And as you get concentration of wealth, those people don't make money on salary. They make money on investments, and they're paying lower taxes. So you have this investor class, I call them, which is very wealthy people who basically make money on investments. And they're paying about half the tax rate that working folks do. That's the loophole that has to close.
So you would make that investor tax equivalent to what we pay in payroll.
That's right. What I might do is create a lower capital gains rate if you hold the investment for 10 years, right? Because that encourages people investing in startups. That encourages people investing in infrastructure, two things we need more of, startups and infrastructure. But a huge amount of capital gains is people who trade stocks, do leverage buyouts, all that kind of stuff. They don't need a lower tax rate. The capital gains rate is kind of an outdated incentive, right? We used to have a situation where people with money didn't invest, and that was hurting the economy. So we created this preferential tax rate to get them to off the sideline. We don't have that problem today. Yeah. Markets are very sophisticated. They're very liquid and people invest. But see, that's how I think. I mean, I don't do stuff for political purposes necessarily. Okay. What I just explained is where actually all the leakage in the tax code is. All the disparity in the tax code is not the high marginal rate because very few people actually make their wealth through, maybe athletes do and you know, NBA players and movie stars, they get paid in salaries, huge numbers. But most of the real wealth is creating capital gains. So you can raise the marginal rate all you want. You're not going to capture where really a lot of the wealth gets taxed. It's at the capital gains level.
Well,
so
thank
nice
you
to
very
you,
much.
Cal.
This
thank
has
you.
Been special having you here today. And
I've enjoyed it.
I'm
will you
looking
have me
forward.
Back?
Oh, absolutely.
Good.
We'd be happy to have you back.
And I didn't pound on the table.
Thank you, Cal. Candidates with Cal. This is Local Talk on KHOI. Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty Hansen comes by once a month to report on the Ames City Council. So, Bronwyn, let's talk City of Ames for a few minutes.
Yes, thank you.
What's coming down the road in April?
We've got a couple of workshops in April, two workshops actually, which is a lot. We usually only have one workshop a month. But this Tuesday, tomorrow, we're having a workshop to update Council on the comprehensive plan, which has been a big project, and I've mentioned that before.
Just real briefly summarize what that is.
So the comprehensive plan is meant as an update to what we used to call our land use policy plan, which guides decisions related to how we grow and where we grow, where we would consider annexing a new land or incentivizing development, things like that. Our old plan was pretty outdated, and so we're starting on this new one, but we're calling it a comprehensive plan because not only is it land use strategy, but it will also involve sustainability efforts, involve our transportation system will all sort of be wrapped up in one plan because land use is somewhat guided by those things too, if you think about it, like where you're going to grow is guided by where your transportation network is strong and et cetera. So to not include your transportation plan is sort of short-sighted. So that's why we're doing the new, what we call comprehensive plan. We had a lot of public input sessions for this comprehensive plan. And tomorrow night's workshop, council won't be making any, we're not being asked to make any decisions necessarily other than just to get an update on how the public input sessions have been going, the input we've been getting, and if we do want to make any slight course alterations, it would be the time to do it. Council won't be making any decisions, just getting an update from the consultant that we've hired to develop this plan.
And then you're going to be having a forum on human trafficking this month, right?
Right. That's the second workshop we're having, and that'll be the third Tuesday. The topic is human trafficking and what, if anything, we can do in Ames to make a stronger system for fighting human trafficking. And this is spearheaded by the Coalition Against Human Trafficking. George Belitzos, formerly of YSS, is spearheading that effort. And so there's been a conversation about what we can do or if there are other maybe licensing requirements that we could impose as a city that might make it easier for the police department to enforce or go in and check the legitimacy of a massage business, usually is what we're talking
about. And there have been some cases in Ames where trafficking has been spotted.
Yeah, yep, exactly. And then recently in Des Moines, there was a bust of several of these seedy massage parlors.
So and it's not a can't happen here type of scenario.
It is not, no. Yeah, we have to think about sexual trafficking here and human trafficking, and it's a sad situation to have to consider, but it is present here and we need to be combating it.
When again is that?
That'll be the third Tuesday of April, 6 p.m. Yep, in the council chambers on that one, yep.
Okay, so also stuff has been going on the state level that influences Ames as a city?
Yeah, there have been a couple of bills we've been keeping our eyes on down at the State House. One of them would undo a lot of the work we did last year. The state is basically is proposing that cities should not be allowed to institute rental caps like we did. Iowa City and Ames both instituted rental caps. They look slightly different in a sense, but same type of idea in both communities.
So there's probably nobody in the city of Ames that does not know what a rental cap is by now, but just in case, just give us a brief explanation about the word rental cap.
You got it. Yeah. So what we did last year was we set a limit on the percentage of properties in given areas in town that could have a rental permit. So in the campus neighborhoods, for example, only 25% of the properties are allowed to get a rental permit in those neighborhoods. Basically what it is in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. And so the legislature is considering making that impossible to do.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Driven, of course, by a strong realty lobby. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, and I feel it's unfortunate because I think we came to a really great compromise through a lot of effort last year. So it's really...
And a lot of public input.
A lot, yeah. So it was the item that we've heard the most about of all my time on council. And so that's kind of disheartening to have the state take away a community's ability to do that. And it's another example, too, of the state taking power back from the local communities. And there are some decisions that are best made at a higher level of government, perhaps, but I think there are others that community is best able to handle because they have a better feel on the nature of their community. And I think the rental cap is one of those. The other decision they're considering at the State House would affect how we collect property tax dollars, and it would have some serious financial implications. Not only for Ames, but other communities, I think, would feel it worse. But what they're proposing is that they would put a limit on how much a city could increase its tax levy. And Ames has always been really pretty responsible with our tax levy. Just to review this, too, a city in Iowa is limited to $8.10 per thousand for a city tax levy. And many, many communities are maxed out. They're already charging that $8.10 per thousand in most of the communities of our size across Iowa. But Ames does not. We're at like $5 and change out of that $8.10 limit. Our city's tax levy is really quite reasonable and responsible. But what the state's decision will do will limit our ability to increase that, which, again, we don't see a need to increase it rapidly. But if you had a big disaster come up, if you had some big infrastructure project that you needed to invest in, you know, sort of before you see the resulting growth, it really, really limits a city's ability to be able to respond to any crisis like that or to be able to invest in a project. So we're really concerned about what that might mean, too. So keeping our eye on the state as well.
To be further observed, right?
Yeah, exactly.
One last thing. So the parking meter prices went down, right?
Yes. Hopefully people are liking that. That started April 1st. Well, we got it done a little bit earlier. Our deadline for ourselves was April 1st. But we'll see what that does. Hopefully the traffic will pick up a little. And we'll see that at the end of the fiscal quarter that we're in. We'll do a look at those numbers.
So. Okay. So you're getting good reviews. Okay. Well, thank you, Bronwyn Vady Hansen, Councilwoman at Large. And we'll see you next month again.
Yes.
We're going to end the show today with this silent uprising that's happening all over Ames and all over the state. That is the tree sap. And we do have somebody who collects tree sap, right, in Ames?
This spring is the first time I've seen it, but there's a guy going around. I think his name is Ben. The company is Front Yard Sugar, where he'll go up to your house if you have maple trees in your yard and ask, hey, can I tap into this maple tree? And then he's reducing that sap down and selling it. So, yeah, it's an interesting business venture.
All right. So tree sap. Here's Pat Schlarbaum.
Phenology is writing down nature's happenings when they occur. The first pelican flock of spring or the last osprey of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles of Marshalltown writes, phenology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phenology is about tree sap. A delightful stirring of spring is occurring even as we speak. As buds are swelling on trees in our yards, sap is coursing through the passageways of the tree. Think of these passageways, called xylem and phloem tubes, as the arteries and veins, like in our bodies. Sap is the blood of the tree, filled with nutrients and minerals. It carries vital energy out into the branches when new buds are forming in springtime. And in spring, summer, and autumn, sap flows through a part of the outer tree trunk known as sapwood. Xylem transports water, minerals, and hormones from the bottom to the top of the tree in a long string formation. Each year, the xylem channels die off and new ones are produced. When you fell a tree and are faced with those wonderful rings, you are seeing the old xylem channels, one ring for each year of life. Phloem, however, is the sticky, sugary stuff we tend to come into contact with, whether by accident or on purpose. This is made up of the sugars created by photosynthesis, which is then fed back into the tree and leaves as much-needed food during the growth period. Although sap generally flows during the day when temperatures are warm, it has been known to flow at night if temperatures remain above freezing. Daytime temperatures in the plus 40s and nighttime temperatures below freezing are ideal for sap movement in trees. There are a few reasons why you might come into contact with sap, with some being desirable and some not. Some trees produce bitter or even poisonous sap. Plus, even edible sap licked directly from the tree is not very tasty. However, when the next time you drizzle maple syrup on your waffles, just remember that it comes from tree sap. Sap contains sugar and water and is extracted from trees using buckets and spikes. Maple syrup comes from the sap of maple trees. A tree uses sap in two ways. They either, one, pull sap from the water in the soil, transport it up through its trunk, and send it out through its leaf pores, or stomata. Or two, sap flows down off of the leaves towards the roots and other parts of the tree because it contains the vital sugar, the food. The tree is synthesized during photosynthesis. Tapping a tree does create a wound, but it is a wound from which the tree can readily recover and does not endanger the health of the tree. Commercial syrup producers are able to tap trees for decades without adversely affecting the health of the tree. A vigorous tree will heal or grow over a tap hole in 1 year. One very popular tree is the sugar maple. Its sap has a sugar content of up to 2%, and they make a lot of it. It is tapped in late winter and early spring, with a healthy, good-sized tree producing as much as 15 gallons of heavenly sweetness. On average, it takes about 40 gallons of sap to make just 1 gallon of delicious syrup. It's about a 40-to-1 ratio. As well as maples, there are a few other trees that produce edible sap. The black walnut will yield tasty sap. The sap of many birch trees is also very nutritious. While it's low on sugar, it's a great source of minerals and natural antioxidants. In Korea, the goroso is the most common source of sap. Traditionally, it's used raw as a hot beverage rather than boiled down into syrup. The aforementioned uses of tree sap are undoubtedly positive. However, our other interactions with it might not be so much fun. Often the reason we encounter sap on the outside of a tree is because something is wrong. Leaking sap on the bark can be a sign of disease, pests, or damage. However, the tree's own sap can often serve as an effective defensive mechanism. From your point of view, sap can either be a nuisance or a delicious treat, but to your trees, it's vital. Look out for unusual leaks and consider sap activity when deciding when to trim. And if you have a maple on your property, read up on how to tap it. If you have trees, you're going to have sap, so make the most of it. Also known as pitch, tree resin is thicker, tackier, and darker than tree sap. Deciduous trees do not make resin. It is only produced by trees that belong to the pine, fir, or cedar family. Resin forms in the outer cells of the trees, also known as the inner and outer bark. Outer bark is also known as the phloem. You can make a cut into a resin-producing tree and see the resin ooze out of the bark. The resin is meant to work like a scab. It closes up the wound and protects it from outer elements while it heals. Resin is sticky and clear and composed differently than tree sap. It is composed of compounds secreted by or deposited in the tree and sometimes contain high levels of chemical properties. For this reason, it is used for a variety of commercial and industrial applications. Maple syrup is not one of them. Resin is used to manufacture commodities like ink, lacquer, varnish, jewelry, perfume, and many other commercial products. Pine resin, or as some call it, pitch, can be chewed like gum, and Native Americans routinely chewed and consumed the resin for its antibacterial properties and for joint pain. Native Americans use resin to make the inner workings of their ceremonial whistles. And that's our phonology of tree sap this time of year. Theme music is John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio. Become a member. Find the donate button at our website, khoifm.org. www.ksat.org. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at oasco.org.
And you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. noon and 7 p.m. Also remember, you can hear a recording of today's shows online at khoifm.org later on in the day and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Your engineer has been Cynthia McClure. Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you for listening. And remember that you've made KHOI and Local Talk meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.